Our next topic, interference to broadcast facilities, will be presented by Jeremy Ruck, principal engineer with Jeremy Ruck and Associates of Canton, Illinois. He has been working in the field of broadcasting for over 25 years, and for nearly all of that time has concentrated on transmission plant consulting. Jeremy is a graduate of Bradley University in Peoria, Illinois, and holds a Bachelor of Science in Electrical Engineering. He's a registered professional engineer in the state of Illinois and is a full member of the Association of Federal Communications Consulting Engineers. Jeremy authors a bi-monthly column for Radio Magazine and has been a contributor to other broadcast-related publications. Please welcome Jeremy Ruck.
All right, well, good afternoon, everybody. It's a pleasure to be back with you again this year. If I'm a little bit off-key today, I apologize for that. I'm running on about an hour and a half of sleep. We've been doing some extensive night work down in Chicago. So as soon as I get done, I've got to head back. So hopefully I'll get a chance to see some of you, though, before I do. I do want to say a special thanks to Chuck and to Linda for being extremely patient with me this year. I was very, very, very tardy in getting my presentation to them, and they were very gracious. So I just wanted to mention that. As you guys know, usually when I do a presentation, if you've got a question, feel free to stop me anytime and ask me, and we'll break the ice here a little bit before we get into the meat of it here. How many out there, show of hands, are interested in astronomy, things like that? Guys, good? Okay, yeah, all right. I saw the summer, you know, we had the Olympics this summer, and there were some funny things that were floating around about people calling us fat and stupid, and of course, you know, we won the Olympics and landed on Mars. And what we found this year on Mars was that, in fact, there is life on Mars. Now, what is this? Well, curiosity did, in fact, kill the cat. And speaking of Mars, this is a view of the Milky Way from Mars. As you guys know, I live in Illinois. That's some kind of a southern state. A lot of the guys I work with in Chicago kid me about living south of Interstate 80. Not only do I live south of Interstate 80, but I live south of Interstate 74. And I don't know why they get on me about being a southerner. I mean, this is my new central heating system for this year. Speaking of energy, anybody know what this is? Yeah, the latest in energy drinks. Exactly. All right, finally, we have some strange characters down there. I don't know if there's a warrant out for this guy yet or not. And then finally, we seem to be having parenting problems all the time these days. And so it happens even in ladder families as well. Okay, today I want to talk about a little bit about is interference. This is going to be kind of a top-level thing. I'm going to concentrate on some allocations. I don't think I even put any equations in this presentation, so I'm not going to hit you guys with that today. There are a couple of things, though, as we get into this that I hope you'll pick up that I'm leaning towards, that I want you to take away from this presentation, that are very, very key things to remember, especially with the state of the radio industry these days and translators. I'll give you a hint, okay? So let's begin. Interference, you know, you guys know I like to start out with a definition, so I brought up several of them here. This is one definition: confusion of a received radio signal due to the presence of noise as atmospherics or signals from two or more transmitters on a single frequency. That makes sense. I think we're all pretty comfortable with that. A second one that would also apply, radio signals that make the sound or picture of a radio or television program difficult to hear or see clearly, or the noise caused by this. Your dictionary, one of these online things, static unwanted signals producing a distortion as the sounds or images and preventing good reception. And then finally, I like this one. This one's kind of more of a physics type of definition, but interference is the interaction of two or more waves passing the same point. I think intuitively that makes sense, okay? My definition, the one that we're going to use here that I think kind of sums the whole thing up, is any condition in which you have an undesired to desired signal ratio that is exceeded. Okay. Now, what is that ratio? Well, it's going to be a function of a number of different things. Obviously, the FCC has different ratios that they use, and some of those are somewhat archaic. They're based on older receiver technology and things like that. Today, we may find that with greater selectivity in receivers, interference is not quite as big of an issue. For instance, co-channel with digital receivers now is not quite as big of a problem as it used to be. And indeed, a number of years ago, we saw that the commission actually changed those protection ratios. There was, and I think I talked about this a couple years ago, but there used to be an anomaly in the spacing table whereby you could slightly short space certain FM stations, but there was absolutely no way to make the contour protection work. Okay, and this was the old 20 dB ratio that was in the table. Well, because the spacing table winds up sort of being, you know, the de facto standard, the commission really didn't want to play at the spacing table. So what they did was hem-hawed around for a number of years, waited for the receiver technology to catch up and say, oh, we'll just add another 20 dB to it. So that's why the FM guys, we have basically the same protection ratio between a second and a third adjacent channel. Interference, of course, we can be caused by natural signals. I think that makes sense. We see that every day. And, of course, it is frequently caused by man-made signals. Okay. Similar signal type is not required. I think everybody knows that. When you get harmonics, they can wind up in a different part of the band. FM guys can interfere with TV. Two-way guys with a different modulation scheme can interfere with us and vice versa. So it does not require, you know, the same type of signal or modulation scheme. Once again, it's that U to D ratio that is important. And when that is exceeded, that's when we start having the problems. Of course, as I just mentioned, cross-signal or cross-service interference can and regularly does occur. So that's something that has to be watched out for. Okay, natural signals, these are kind of common sense. Lightning, all right, we're all pretty familiar with that. Wind, believe it or not, okay? The sun. Thermal noise, cosmic background radiation. There's our astronomy theme. We've got to throw that back in there again. And then other stuff. I always do a catch-all, you know, to make sure. It's sort of an engineer's way of covering your rear to make sure that you got, you know, totally everything covered. Okay, lightning. Lightning, of course, creates very powerful radio signals in the 3 kilohertz to the 10 megahertz range. Anybody out there that's a ham radio operator that hangs out on, I see some hands there. Anybody that hangs out on 80 meters, 40 meters, we're all relatively intimate with this type of interference. Excuse me. The VLF signatures, which are the ones on the very bottom end of the band, the 3 kilohertz to the 30 kilohertz range, these guys can end up traveling around the world. And indeed, the United States military uses communications in this range for tracking submarines and other military assets because of the propagation characteristics. So if you are monitoring some of these very low frequencies like this, just because you hear a strike doesn't mean it's, you know, in Wisconsin or Michigan. It could be in Ethiopia or somewhere, you know, halfway around the world. The shortwave signatures, which exist in the higher frequency range, of course, they tend to travel a little bit shorter distance, but still, they can go halfway around the world. All right, so lightning is not necessarily a localized phenomenon. It can interfere with your station even though it's many, many miles away from the source or the storm. A recently discovered lightning phenomenon within the past few years is called red sprite lightning. And red sprite lightning is kind of cool because it exists in the very upper reaches of the storm. When we start looking at storms at 40, 50,000 foot tops, this is where we start seeing the red sprite lightning, which takes off from the top of the anvil and travels up to the ionosphere. Okay. Now, the reason that red sprite is kind of interesting is the fact that it winds up creating problems in a much higher frequency range. We tend to see interference from it in the 1 kilohertz range all the way up and through VHF. So not only can FMs experience localized interference from this, but other 2A, RPUs, things like that, other types of ancillary communication. Of course, with lightning, there's absolutely no way to mitigate it. It's very, very transient in nature. You know, they always say lightning doesn't strike twice. I know some people would doubt that. However, with the transient nature like that, there really is a minimal way to predict it. And of course, it's going to be gone just as quickly as it shows up. Okay, our wind interference, this functions similar to lightning as well. Because remember, lightning, we're just talking about a spark discharge across a gap that creates this interference. The high winds can create a static buildup on a tower, okay? And when you start getting arcing, this can interfere with your signal. This, of course, tends to be a highly localized phenomenon, all right, just due to the intensity and the size of it. When we're arcing across Johnny balls or something like that, it's not, you know, we're not talking very powerful, you know, currents and voltages relative to a lightning blast. So, you know, this may not be experienced very often, but on occasion you may see it. One of the things, if you have a new AM tower, you may see this more often than not because there hasn't been as much dust and dirt built up on the insulators. And so it does effectively build up until the dielectric breaks down and arcs across. Over time, when you get dirt and grime and stuff building up, you get a high impedance path, which tends to discharge some of that before it has a chance to arc. Of course, we can also effectively reduce some of this through static discharge schemes. That's your static drain choke, things like that. Also, keep in mind that the same scheme that we would do to maybe reduce some wind problems, we can also do to help mitigate lightning. But never forget, and I know Jeff Welton talked about this a couple of years ago, there is absolutely no way to prevent lightning strikes, you know, from taking things out. And no matter what you do to try and mitigate that, there is the chance of the mother of all strikes hitting and basically melting everything down. And of course, once again, this is a very transient type of phenomenon. Okay, the sun, we're in a higher sunspot cycle right now. And so, you know, we're going to see some more experiences of sun outages and things like that. The sun radiates across the entire spectrum, okay? It's not just light and heat that we see. And of course, heat doesn't really count as electromagnetic radiation. But the sun is a very effective X-ray source. It's a very effective radio source. And so when it shines, you're getting all across the spectrum, you're getting signals from it. Of course, everybody should have satellite dishes. You guys are probably well aware of the satellite outage that occurs. This happens, of course, around the equinoxes, spring and summer. And depending on the latitude and which hemisphere you're in, is which dates it affects. 12 minutes or less tends to be the typical outage time. GPS, of course, can be affected by the sun. This is one of the big fears that NASA and Commerce Department and military has been worried about with the sunspot cycle currently right now and the potential of solar storms, is what is it going to do to the satellite navigation system? Because the last time that we had a fairly substantial solar maxima, GPS was not in play. Okay, and think about, you know, how many devices we have that actually rely on GPS. It's not just the TomTom in your car anymore. The TV guys, you guys are using it for a lock. Radio guys are using it for a time-based lock. So sun affecting GPS can have some fairly catastrophic interference issues to our industry as well as to the wireless guys and some of the other industries. Now, typically with the sun, we usually see this around the HF frequencies. So once again, it's those of us that are the hams that tend to get spanked by it. Other frequencies, though, can be affected when we get into the more stronger storms. When we start looking at things like an R4 or an R5 blackout, which a couple of them occur, you know, per cycle, you can have fairly substantial disruption of communication across the sunlit side of the Earth, and that can translate even into broadcast interference. Northern Lights, that's one. You guys up here in the north in Wisconsin, you're more susceptible to getting that than we are down in the tropics. It's got to be a real wing-dinger for us to get them. But the Northern Lights is a phenomenon that can affect the propagation depending on how strong and severe they are. As I mentioned, the sun also tends to be a very strong radio source, so we will see bursts from the sun. And these can occur across wide ranges of spectrum, and depending on where the blow is directed, can affect our satellite microwave communications, usually more them than some of the other stuff. Okay, thermal. We also call this Johnson-Nyquist noise, and this is basically a function of heat. So any circuit that exists above absolute zero, or 459.67 Fahrenheit, 273.15 for you metric guys, is going to have thermal noise, all right? And this is the result from the motion of the atoms within it. There's no way to correct it other than to cool things down. This is the reason why in spacecraft and other very, very critical sources, you see cooling done with liquid helium and other exotic things like that. That's to reduce this type of effect. Obviously, if you hit absolute zero, the motion of the atom ceases, so you know you're not functioning anyway. Passive components on a shelf will simply just by themselves generate thermal noise. Okay, this is a contributor to the noise system floor that we see, or system noise floor that we see in test gear and receivers. Okay, it's not the only contributor, but it is one of them. And this, of course, does tend to be low level, but if you are looking at a satellite system or perhaps a microwave system, this can be a factor if you're right on the margins. Okay, cosmic background radiation. Usually the atmosphere tends to shield this out, but I thought I'd mention it anyway because it's kind of a cool topic. This was discovered in 1964, and basically what it is radiation left over, or it's explained to be radiation left over from the early universe when the so-called Big Bang happened. The intensity of the cosmic background is roughly uniform across the entire sky, and it contributes to the static in receivers. Okay, so that's part of the white noise you hear is not only the thermal noise, but it's also the cosmic background radiation that is still reaching the Earth. The cosmic background radiation is currently pegged with a black body spectrum at 2.725 K. It's very low temperature. A black body radiator basically has a peak in its radiation spectrum, and it corresponds to particular frequencies, and then has a distribution. Currently, the peak is measured at about 160.2 gigs, so that's kind of a little bit above the areas where we operate, but some of it does track down into it, so it can potentially be a factor in some areas. It's been described as the most perfect black body ever measured, and as I mentioned, it's very low level in nature. Okay, other stuff, as I mentioned, always got to have a catch-all category. This is for basically anything else that I forgot. There may be other sources, so you know this is it. And any other process that causes interference that we haven't specifically discussed, we'd sort of throw into this bin here. Okay, for man-made signals, basically we can categorize them under two categories. You've got intentional interference, all right? That's your guys that are jamming you, actually maliciously causing interference. As a general rule, I think that most of the time, interference that we experience as broadcasters is not really intended to be malicious, at least not by other broadcasters. All right, you may have the guy that's on the fringe, it's a pirate or something like that that's causing problems. But as broadcasters, I think we tend to be fairly respectful of our neighbors, and if there is some interference being caused, it's not really necessarily intentional. It may be from a lack of taking care of a problem, but as far as it being intentional and malicious, I don't think that that's usually the case. Which, of course, leads us to unintentional interference. This can be anything from, your tube is throwing off spurs. We've got a directional antenna. I was talking with a couple of guys earlier about some interference that's being received over Milwaukee. And, perhaps your directional array is out of tolerance at night. Okay, so I would throw that into sort of unintentional interference. What is important to remember is nearly anything that uses electricity in one form or another can be a potential source of interference to your signal. Obviously, the localization and the effect of this interference is going to vary depending on the source and the magnitude of the source. So, this thing does like to skip. Our unintentional interference, we all know this, fluorescent lights. I imagine sometimes you've probably got some of you guys, especially guys that are engineers of the VHF TV stations, probably have gotten numerous calls about people not being able to receive off-air signals. That phenomenon is not necessarily a signal level problem. It's really more of a noise problem. And fluorescent, including our wonderful CFL lights, are a very, very big contributor to that. Not only does the light stink, they affect our broadcasting, and it's a toxic waste dump in your house. So it's good thing that was done with that. Motors, large motors, you get the brushes start getting worn down, things like that start up and stop. If you're in a plant or some sort of industrial facility, that can interfere with your reception and perhaps lead to complaints. Electrical contacts, the old switches. Remember, you had an AM radio, flip the switch and hear the click. These tend to be, very small and transient in nature, but they can affect it. Other contacts such as thermostats or anything that switches on and off with a hard contact like that can be a source. Dimmer switches, there's a good one for you. Rheostat usually affects AM. Electric fences, yeah. Big source, especially out in some of the rural areas when we start getting down to the lower signal levels from the stations in town. Power lines, we all know about that one. And of course, there are numerous other ones, which they're just too many to mention. A lot of these sources mimic what we call synchrotron type of radiation. And of course, then we also have the non-broadcast communications facilities. That's your two-way guys, wireless internet, stuff like that. And then finally, AM, FM, and TV stations. All right. One note about unintentional interference. I've had clients call before and say, you know, hey, I'm getting interfered by this guy, and I'm an FM and he's an FM, and he's just, you know, totally stomping all over me. We need to go check and make sure that, you know, he's not cranking his power up. One of the things to remember is that's probably somewhat unlikely, because most of the times when we design a facility, you don't have much headroom in the transmitter power for obvious cost reasons. So to get that kind of interference, you know, you'd have to install a significantly larger transmitter, which is probably not happened. So a lot of times those tend to be bogus. It's more of an atmospheric condition than anything else. Okay, the commission. One of the charges that the commission has, of course, is to help regulate us. Broadcasters are somewhat unique in the fact that we actually asked for regulation. I think in this day and age when everybody's trying to get away from some of the regulation, it's kind of funny to look that as an industry, we specifically asked for it. And I think as a general rule, people tend to play by the rules. Just as some history here, the Radio Act of 1912 begins the regulation of radio in the United States. Does anybody remember what happened in 1912? Yeah, it's Titanic, exactly. What had happened was the signals were being sent out, and there was a neighboring ship nearby, but they had no radio operator on duty, okay? And so with the regulation under the Radio Act of 1912, that was when ships were required to have an operator at the control point at all times. Of course, there's the punchline. And as part of this, it required all stations to be licensed. Prior to that time, it was sort of hobbyists and things like that, and you could sort of squat on whatever frequency you wanted to. So in 1912, we finally start seeing the first movement towards dealing with interference and making sure that everybody's playing on a somewhat level field and operating together. It was expanded in 1927, and the Radio Act of 1927 superseded the 1912 law. And this is the law that created what was called the Federal Radio Commission. And the Federal Radio Commission was a forerunner to our FCC. There were five commissioners assigned, basically one for each of the time zones. And it wound up being a somewhat unwieldy type of arrangement. But it was the original genesis as to the first really organizational scheme that led to the commission, which was created in 1934. Of course, 1934 then, now that you got an FCC, you don't need the FRC, so it was abolished. That's not something we see too often, where a new program gets rid of an old one. And of course, the interference protection does definitely tie in with fair distribution of service. That's the other mandate of the commission is, or one of the other mandates is the fair distribution. And if you've got stations that are interfering with each other, you're depriving communities of service in that. So that's one of the key points as to why interference protection was brought into it. And of course, obviously, the rules were established to regulate this. Okay, AM station interference. I'm going to sort of gloss over AM a little bit because the FM stuff is sort of where I want to get to some of the meat of it. We've got three primary conditions we look at when we talk about AM interference, and these happen to do with the time of day. Of course, daytime, nighttime, and critical hours. All right. The daytime, we use basically two main factors to determine that. That's your antenna efficiency and, of course, your ground conductivity. The antenna efficiency is a function of the radiator height. This is the chart out of the commission's rules, and we use this curve here to basically look at what is the theoretical efficiency of an antenna. This is calculated based on, you know, 120 quarter wave ground system. And it's a very old curve that was actually updated and metricized. And so this version here, although it's not very readable, is stated in millivolts per meter at 1 kilometer. That is the efficiency that you'll see on your license, whether you're non-directional or directional, in terms of an AM station. Now the maximum occurs up here at 0.625. Actually, there's been some theoretical research that actually says that 0.64 lambda may actually be the peak, but for the commission's concerns, we leave it at 0.625. This, of course, is equivalent to a 5/8 wave radiator, and it's 225 electrical degrees at your frequency. Okay, anybody know why the efficiency drops off as you get above 5/8? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, lobes into the sky. It's because of the current distribution in the tower. Okay. A similar phenomenon happens with TV antennas. It's the old center-fed antenna versus the end-fed antenna debate. One manufacturer tends to prefer center fed antennas, but the drawback to that is when you get above 3/4 of a degree of beam tilt, you start getting lobes popping up above the horizontal. So the NFED design takes care of that. You don't get those lobes. So it's a similar type of thing that happens here. Okay, ground connectivity. This is the M3 map that everybody should be pretty much familiar with, or at least know about. The ground connectivity is an estimated value. We use that millisiemens per meter or millimoes per meter, so it's 1/1 ohm. So it's amps over voltage. This is, of course, based on soil types. And your recent climate affects it, all right? I think everybody, if you have a directional aim, you probably see this in the wintertime. You'll see seasonal shifts between your monitor points when all the other parameters stay the same. That's probably a ground connectivity type effect. If you're doing measurements, depends on which side of the fence you're on. If I'm working for you and you want to upgrade your station, we're going to do them in the middle of summertime when it's dry. If I'm on the other side of the fence, we're going to do them in the wintertime, okay? The M3 map, there's a digitized version that's in general use. And of course, measured value always trumps the M3 map if it's available. It's not always available, but it can be acquired if you want. If you do have measured data and you're using it, we look at 10 degrees either side of the measured radio. And of course, the proof is a usual source for that. Key thing to do, if somebody calls you up and says that they're looking at upgrading and they're going to do a bunch of measurements on your station, you may just want to ask them if you can poke along. All right, not to necessarily cast aspersions on anybody, but sometimes decimal places get put in the wrong spot and things like that. And it's always good to be present to ensure that you're adequately being protected. The signal attenuation is also frequency based. So I think we know this intuitively. Higher frequencies are going to be lower at a given distance than a lower frequency. Okay, daytime interference, we currently define that in terms of contour overlap. It wasn't always that way. It used to be done in terms of the ratio that we talk about. But the contour overlap is a much simpler way of doing it. The co-channel, this is a 26 dB ratio, 1 to 20. Okay. The non-class A, it's 0.025 to 0.5. This should be familiar. The A, it's the 005 to the 0.1. So they get protected to a much broader area. The first adjacent is a minus 6 dB ratio now. About 20 years ago, I think it was, in the early 90s, scary, I can actually say that now and remember it. In the early 90s, the commission changed the rules. Prior to that time, it was a 1-to-1 ratio on the first adjacent. And as part of the improvement of the so-called AM band, it was changed to this 1-to-2 ratio now. If you have existing 1-to-1, remember, you're grandfathered in, you don't have to change it. But if you do, you know, modify your facility or whatever, you can increase that area of overlap. Second adjacent stayed at a 1-to-1. That's the 5 mil to 5 mil. And the third is a 25. Okay, when we start looking at this, we consider the stations in terms of their authorized power and field. If it's a non-directional, we're going to use a theoretical value that's on file, unless we've got something that's established differently. The DA, of course, is going to use the authorized pattern, whether that's a standard or an augmented pattern. Now, there's a special case that exists for the Class C guys, and this is kind of goofy, but it's the way the rules work. The proposed facility, the one proposing to make the changes, is considered at 250 watts for both its interfering and protected service contour. The guy to which he's looking is considered at 250 watts for his interfering contour, but he's protected at 1,000 watts. Okay? So what this means is if you have a Class C and you're trying to make some changes, that's your 1400, 1230, 1340, those frequencies. If you're trying to make a change with a Class C, it doesn't matter about moving the power level up and down. Okay? The predicted interference, based on the commission's rules, is going to be a function of the distance, the connectivity, and the radiator efficiency. Okay? So unlike with the Class Bs and the Ds, where we can vary power and things like that, we don't have that option with the Cs. Okay, very important point to keep in mind, the authorization of a pattern or an antenna without contour overlap does not necessarily imply that after construction there will be no contour overlap. Of course, why is that? Well, quite simply, if the application was based off the theoretical connectivity and the actual connectivity is something different, there may be interference. The problem is you can't go to the commission about this. You just sort of got to live with it. That's just sort of the problem, that the way things work out with the allocations. Okay, this is a particular case that I worked on. This is a station out in South Dakota that is actually awaiting the issuance of a construction permit. It's a station on 860, and this is a daytime protection here. And what we did was we used two towers to keep the contour overlap from happening right here. If we went non-directional, we would have had overlap, and there would have been interference. What's interesting to note, though, is we had some measured data, which actually shows the conductivity may be a little bit higher. And so you can see we've wound up with a little bit of overlap here. Okay, so in this particular case, the difference between the M3 and the actual connectivity resulted in some interference to the receiving station in Minnesota. Okay, nighttime interference, we're going to really go through this quickly. This is a site-to-site RSS calculations in most cases. When we do this, we look at all the stations in Region 2. That's basically the Western Hemisphere. The Class A guys are protected to the half mil, 50% sky wave. If you want to get an idea of what that distance is, think of the distance between about Detroit and Kansas City. That'll give you sort of a rough idea of the area to which they're protected. We also consider first adjacent domestic when we're looking at the nighttime. And the adjacent Class A also gets protection out to their half mil ground wave at night. They're protected from interference there. Okay. There's no cross-border international protection. That's something important to keep in mind, is that if your signal goes into Canada, for say, you're protected only within the United States. They can stop and interfere with you all they want north of the border. Similarly, their guys coming down south of the border, we can do the same thing. Okay. That's a treaty issue, of course. And at nighttime, the interference-free contour is protected. There have been some cases where the site-to-site has shown that there hasn't been any interference, but when you actually plot out the contours, you see that there's some overlap with the interference-free. Okay, so there's some accommodations that's made for that. Half of this value, I kind of consider a reasonable extent of coverage. Beyond that, you're going to start getting a lot of interference from other stations. Critical hours, this is a special case to the Class A's, addresses the fact that the Earth is not flat, that it is in fact round, and that the sun rises at different times. Of course, sunrise at 2 hours after and 2 hours before. What was interesting is this was bandied around for almost 12 years before they finally addressed this problem of the critical hours interference. And of course, this was back in the heyday of AM. It's a co-channel situation that we look at, okay? And the calculations, there are two sections of the rules. And these sections of the rules use two graphs and a couple of interpolation factors. All right, so it's pretty easy. It's a hand type of calculation you can do, or you can do it in the computer. And the limit is based on the azimuth and the distance to your Class A. Okay, FM interference. We've talked about this before previously. The interference and coverage, of course, is based on a couple of sets of curves. The non-reserve channels, that's the commercial guys above 221 and up, we primarily, of course, use spacings to demonstrate a lack of interference in these areas. The reserve channels, which are the non-com guys, we use the contour method down there. What's important to remember is that interference may occur under either method. All right, just because on paper it looks good doesn't necessarily mean in reality that you're going to be good because there are flaws with the commission's model. The ratios that we look at are a minus 20. For co, minus 6 for first, and of course the plus 40 for the second and third. And the protected value varies with the class. A, B, and B1 and C have different flavors if they're commercial. Non-coms are all protected the same value from interference. Now the spacing table that we all look at is based on the commission's curves with reference facilities and flat uniform terrain. So here's an example. Let's say we've got two co-channel Class A's that we're looking at. If you look at the table under 73207, we're going to see it's a 115-kilometer spacing. So the commission says, hey, no interference at that distance. And as part of that, we're going to say that there's no overlap of the 40 with the 60 of either station. Well, if you calculate the contours based on assuming that both facilities are 6 and 100 meters, what we find is that the 60 contour is 28 kilometers and the 40 is 87 kilometers. The sum of those two is 115. All right, so that's the derivation of the spacing table. Now, I think it doesn't take very much thought to see where that can fall apart quite easily. Remember, the average terrain is based on the average of a number of radials, and if some of those radials are skewed in greater directions than others, you may wind up with a contour overlap situation that would not necessarily be predicted by the spacing table, which will result in an interference situation. Now, we do permit short spacings of the contour protection. We all know about that. There are absolute minimum spacings that you do have to meet. And, of course, those are factor in with the restrictions on the directional antennas. Okay. And once again, can't hammer this enough. Achieving spacings does not necessarily imply contour protection, nor does it imply no interference. Of course, in some cases where we meet them, we are going to have the overlap. Okay, once again, we can still have it if we have both met. Recall our definition. And the commission's model is not real world. Remember that it's looking at a slice of the terrain from 3 to 16 kilometers, averaging that and applying it to the curve. All right? I use an infinite brick wall model when I talk about it that, you know, the commission's model may say you have coverage at 17 kilometers, but if it's 16 and a half, you've got a brick wall. Guess what? There ain't no signal on the other side. Okay. Similarly, it works the other way around in terms of receiving interference. So it was done for ease of calculation when we didn't have a lot of computing power, and it's kind of a nice standard benchmark, but it is a very flawed model. And of course, being the government, they have an escape clause for this. Okay, permittees and licensees of FM broadcast stations are not protected from any interference which may be caused by the grant of a new station or of authority to modify the facilities of an existing station in accordance with the provisions of the subpart. And then if that wasn't clear enough, under Part B, the nature and extent of your protection is only based on assignments being made under that section. Okay, so that's how they give themselves an out when people come and complain and say, hey, you know, you authorized our station, we met your rules, but now we've got all kinds of interference. Let's take a look at a case. This is a station down in Peoria, and I just sort of pulled this one out of a hat because I knew that it was one that would meet it. We can see here that WZPW actually meets the spacing margins to everybody. Okay, let me back up here. Okay, so it meets all the spacings. So as far as the commission is concerned, there's actually no interference taking place. Let's take a look at it. What we've got here, this is the protected service contour for the station. And what I did was I just included the top four or five offenders. So to make things a little bit easier to see, we'll drop off all the background so we just see the county lines and keep the contour there. Now, what we're going to look at is the four stations, and they're going to be individually color-coded here. And what I'll do is I'm going to bring on their interference contours one by one, and CPY's is way up here, so there's quite a bit of clearance between the two facilities. Next, we've got WKXQ down in Rushville, Illinois, which is a little bit closer. WLSR, which is second adjacent. So that was a nice one to throw in there. And then, of course, this guy here, which is tangential. Okay. So under the commission's rules, even under the contour protection, we could say that there would be no interference being caused to WZPW by any of these stations. Well, in reality, look at this. Okay. This is some of the interference, and we can even see that there's some showing up in the protected contour. What about this stuff out here? Well, that's our U to D ratio again. Okay, KXQ comes in with a little bit more on the other end. Now, WLSR, of course, well outside the contour and in close proximity to their site, which makes sense. That's more of a blankening type of problem and a localized due to their high field strength. And then finally, WQKQ and their interference. Okay, so here's a prime example, and of course, just about every station out there, you're probably going to see this. If you've plotted up your contours, you're going to know that in certain areas you've probably got interference, and this is what's taking place here. Okay, then just put the backgrounds on for reference so you can sort of see where everything's at. Okay, next one, talk about translators. This is the one I want to really hammer home too. I think everybody agrees there's been a lot of interest in translators, and some of the prices on some of these facilities have been just astronomically exorbitant. How many of you out there would go drop $150,000 at the poker table? Yeah, okay. That's sort of what's going on in some of these facilities that are being shopped around and being floated. I'll show you an example. So if you do have somebody or if you're interested in acquiring a translator, there is some extra caution that must be applied when you look at it, and this is because of the interference rules. Remember, the translators are a secondary service. All right? As a secondary service, they get some latitude in terms of looking at other stations. For instance, we can have contour overlap between a translator and a full power station as long as you can demonstrate no interference. Full power stations cannot do that. Okay, so there is a little bit of latitude there, but since there's no free lunch, the translator is always at fault if it causes interference to a full power station, right? And that doesn't matter if, you know, we're here in Madison, we're trying to pick a station up out of the cities, the Twin Cities, which is, you know, a hyperbolic example. But anyway, if we're trying to pick a station up from a very, very far distant, distant location, and a translator pops on, the translator is at fault because the rules specifically state that regardless of what the signal strength of the full power station is, as long as it's regularly usable, the translator is the problem. Two things I talk about when I deal with translators with clients is talk about grantability and survivability. Okay, grantability is basically, will it pass the commission's muster? Okay, can we get a grant of a construction permit? And a lot of cases you can, even though Rob Gates and some of the guys know that this is probably not going to be a long-term viable facility. The survivability is basically, once you turn it on, is it going to last because of the interference? Or is somebody going to squawk about it? That's going to be the end of it. So this is why it's very important to review diligently any proposal that comes before you for a translator. Contours alone are insufficient. Okay, here's an example. This is one down in Memphis that I found, which I thought was really kind of an interesting one. What we've got here is we've got a translator. It's this guy right here. I tried to do this in colors, but I guess it didn't work out too well. But basically what he's got is he's got a couple of second adjacent stations that he's looking at having to protect. And so you can see right here, this guy, we've got incoming and outgoing contour overlap. So basically what that says is our site's inside his contour. Now the next one down here, which is a co-channel, you can see that there's a very, very small distance between our the translator's interfering contour and the protected contour of the station, whereas obviously the station's contour is going to blast into us. Another situation down here, this is the second adjacent above. And in this particular case, you can see that we're inside his protected contour, but his interfering contour does not touch our protected contour. And then finally, the situation down here, which is the other co-channel on the west side of Memphis. So what I'm pointing out here is this is the second adjacent here, the fact that we've got 274 and 278 versus 276 on the translator. And of course, here's the co-channel situation. Okay, now let's take it to the maps. What we have here is the proposed translator location is right here. This is the one of the stations with their associated 60 dBU contour, and then the other station down here with their associated contour. This is the predicted interfering contour for the translator. Now notice what he's done up here. He's directionalized it, okay? That sometimes can be an indicator that you may have a problem down the road with survivability of a translator if you have to have some sort of a directional characteristic to it. Because what that implies is that the contours are going to be tangential to each other and that there likely will be an interference situation. So you can see, not only is it that he wind up probably doing it over here, but down here, look at that. They're right up against each other. Okay. There's the other one. So as far as the commission's concerned, hey, this is gravy, man. We met the rules. There are no problems here. The second adjacent guys, I didn't address that, but what you can do on there is play with, you can use the vertical pattern and construct a three-dimensional interference area, and if it doesn't reach any population, then you're good on that. Okay, so notice here, these are the areas to be concerned about. Okay, now here's the Lonely Rice coverage of KFFA down in I guess that's in Arkansas. He's located in Arkansas. And we've plotted the 70, the 60, and the 54 here. And once again, for reference, there's our 40, all right, off the translator, tangential to the protected contour. Now look what happens. Okay. So there's quite a bit of interference there. This is even predicted with me being fairly heavy on the ground cover attenuation of both signals. So what we've got is we've got an area here, and it's outside the 60. So yes, it's outside its protected service area, but remember that regardless of the signal strength, the translator is always at fault. So if this happens to lie, you know, this is a fairly rural area, but if this were happened to lie in a city of, you know, 30, 40,000 people, something like that, there may be a real problem with this translator. Here's the flip side of it, and this one's not quite as bad, but there still is a fair amount of interference there. So if you get a translator proposal, run it by your consultant and make sure that they're comfortable with it. I think this particular one, they wanted something like $500,000 for, or something like that. And I would be real concerned about going after that. Okay, DTV, I got about 6 minutes left, so we'll run through this real quick. DTV interference does specifically use Lonely Rice. Calculating that, we begin with the noise limited contour. That's a different signal strength depending on whether you're VHF, low, high, or UHF. And of course, there they are. These are without the dipole adjustment factor. And the genesis of this, of course, is to replicate the old grade B. And the service area includes locations where the field strength exceeds this value inside the contour. And service is considered available if the area is interference-free. Note that this definition will tend to truncate the usable area of the station. All right, why is that? Well, because we've artificially limited the service area to an FCC contour. We know that radio signals don't obey geographic boundaries. And, of course, empirical data confirms this fact. I'm sure a lot of TV engineers out there were pretty amazed when the DTV went on that we had coverage much further than people expected and well outside your contour. Here's an example. I used WIFR down in Rockford. The reason I pulled that one out is because I went back to the Appendix B and I looked for a station that was close that had a fairly high interference level just to make some nice pretty colors on the map here. So we start with the contour and then we put the Lonely Rice in the middle. So you can see any place that's blue in there inside that contour is considered to be the DTV service area. Now we add in the interference and you can see it's nipping away at the fringes. So any of the blue areas inside that contour would be considered the available service area. But when we take the contour away as being the artificial bound, look what happens to the Lonely Rice. It does go out further than that. And if we throw the interference back in, what we can see is that in some areas, yeah, we're going to get stomped on. But down here, places like this, there is going to be some available service. And if you've got an outdoor antenna with some gain, you're going to be that much more likely to pick it up. That's not protected area, but it is still available service area. Okay, microwave, real quick on this too. STL and the intercity relay bands are very congested. We all know that. Coordination is required for applications. That's an interference criteria. You can do self-coordination. There's kind of a thought out there that you have to run it to the frequency coordinators. You don't. You just have to follow the rules. I should be careful saying that because that cuts into my business and Don and Rick's business. Yeah, Kate's business, exactly. Yeah, but that it can be performed. Always designed for your most robust fade margin. I've got an article coming out like next month in radio talking about antennas and sort of the same type of thing. Always, you know, you get what you pay for. So always designed for your most robust fade margin. That will protect you from interference. Remember that a 6 dB loss in your fade margin functions effectively as doubling your path length. Okay? And I don't want to steal too much of Ben's here because I know he's going to talk about some of this. Digital links can be a double-edged sword. You can slam more data down them, but at the same time, they're also susceptible to getting stomped on. How many Illinois guys out here know Wayne Miller? Does the broadcast inspections? Yeah. Wayne absolutely hates digital STLs. He basically yanked them all out. So next time you see him, kid him about that, but don't tell him where he got it from. Squatters, of course, these are the guys that you know, haven't updated their license in 30 years and just decided to sit on a frequency. They can be an interference problem. Temperature inversions, we know about those with lakes and wetlands and things like that. Tropospheric ducting. And then how can we clear that up with our spatial diversity, basically a secondary path to eliminate some of the effects. Okay, that brings us to any final thoughts and questions. I did leave one thing out, but that's probably good that I did because of the time. I was going to put an illustration of doing interference by the commission's contour method. If you're interested in that, drop me an email and I'll send you that just to show you how that works with the commission's method. And I guess that's it. So any questions? I can't see who it is, so you got to help me out.
Oh, I'm mysterious then.
Yeah, you are, yeah.
Well, I just wondered, on the Lonely Rice predictions that you use, what is the standard receive profile? You know, how high is the receive antenna and what sort of antenna?
The standard receive profile is defined by the commission as a function of which service you're in. If you're talking TV, it's a 10-meter AGL. FM's a 9.1 meter AGL, and that was assuming just a dipole. And what I've sort of empirically, qualitatively figured out over the years is that if I leave it at a dipole at 9.1 meters, it's pretty true to what happens with a car radio down at the ground, because you're going to get some gain associated with those type of antennas. You know, any antenna that a radio is going to have is more than likely probably going to have some gain over a dipole. So those were all based on that. That's the other thing. Remember, too, there's still, you know, there's a little bit of hand-waving and black magic associated with this, too. Okay, anything else? Cool. Either bored you guys or explained it real well. All right, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to see each and every one of you and to be associated with you, and thanks to the committee to letting me be part of this again this year.